invitation. Okay, I'll go with you. Rashid gave them instructions to an underground parking facility at the UN building. He pulled a parking pass from his leather folio and gave it to Alex. You have a car? Put this on your dash. It will get you past the guard. He got up, bade them farewell. Until tonight. 9 o'clock behind the UN building, Alex and Paul walked toward the monolithic tower, home of the United Nations Secretariat. Before they had gone 50 yards, a figure stepped out of the shadows and raised his arm, waving toward them. He was still wearing the wrinkled white linen suit from earlier in the day. I trust you had no difficulty parking, said Rashid. None, Alex said. You keep long hours.
No rest for the weary, he replied.
He led them toward a side entrance to the main building. Before they got there, Rashid hailed a janitor who had the door open and was just going inside.
Can you hold the door for us? Thank you.
Rashid slid his keys back into his pocket and led the way toward a service elevator at the back of the building. He turned, smiled, and said,
I cheat. I'm not supposed to use it, but it's so much closer to my office than the main elevators.
2 minutes later, they were in his office, a spacious corner room on the 7th floor with large windows on 2 sides, overlooking the East River. Rashid's nameplate was on the desk, a university diploma on the wall, and a photograph. Rashid with his family, wife, and Paul counted them, 5 children. 2 of them appeared to be adults. Rashid took the chair behind the desk. Please, have a seat. He gestured toward the 2 chairs across from him.
Unless, of course, you'd rather sit on the couch.
This is fine, said Modriani.
Paul was anxious to cut to the chase. He wanted to know what Rashid had and whether, in fact, it might have any impact on his case, and he didn't have much time. For the defense, the Mustafa trial was going nowhere fast. Police had evidence that Mustafa's taxi was in the area of the murder scene the night that Spinova was killed. GPS data from the car's tracking system placed the vehicle close to the vicinity where the body was found. But what was most damaging was the eyewitness testimony of the state's principal witness. Modriani was still trying to figure out how to deal with it. He knew something bad was coming from documents he received during discovery. Perhaps the man would equivocate, but Paul doubted it. And the testimony could prove to be a killer, depending on precisely what the witness said he saw.
Can I offer you anything to drink? Coke? Water?
Both lawyers shook their heads.
Then let's not waste time. As I told you, Spinova went to Libya about 2 weeks after the Benghazi raid on the consulate. But the story begins before that. Late January 2011, the so-called Arab Spring. There were deadly riots all over Egypt. People were dying in the central square in Cairo. You may have seen pictures, said Rashid. Camels trampling some, others being shot.
Modriani and Alex nodded.
Much of this, including fires, buildings torched, took place within a stone's throw of the Museum of Cairo. Have either of you ever been there?
I have, said Alex.
Then you are familiar with some of the artifacts on display. In particular, I am talking about Howard Carter's collection, the treasures from the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Yes, said Alex.
What does any of this have to do with Spinova's murder? Asked Paul.
Bear with me, said Rashid. On the night of January 29th, 2011, under cover of the riots and fires raging outside the museum, thieves broke in and stole items from the Tut collection. What they couldn't carry off, they vandalized. Included among the objects that were taken was a priceless gold figurine of the boy king standing on the back of a panther carved from black ebony. It was one of the premier items recovered by Carter from the tomb in 1922.
Of course, Alex said. It's a spectacular piece.
There is no way to put a dollar value on the object, other than to say that it is priceless. The thieves damaged the base of the statue, the ebony panther. They broke off the gold figurine and took it. We have reason to believe it is still missing.
Yes, but what does this have to do with Spinova? Said Paul.
I'm getting to that. When Spinova went to the burned-out consulate building in Benghazi,
She was intending to take pictures and perhaps write an article about what she saw there. She was hoping to be one of the first to visit the site with a camera, and she assumed that she could benefit financially from the information. However, this all changed after she climbed through one of the open windows of the building because of something she found.
What was that? Alex asked.
She was all in now.
A document, Rashid said. It was a classified memorandum from your CIA referencing items stolen from the museum in Cairo.
Did you know any of this, Paul?
Madriani shook his head from side to side.
Go on.
By now, Alex Cooper was all ears. Madriani had taken out a small notepad from his suit coat pocket and appropriated a corner of the desk to jot down notes. The document in question, we are told, reveals the names, the identities of the thieves involved, including the mastermind behind it. Also, an inventory of what was taken, as well as what was damaged, which the museum has been loath to offer up, and which we believe is considerable.
What exactly is your role in all of this? Asked Alex.
We are part of UNESCO, said Rashid, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Specifically, my office is charged with enforcing the Convention for the Fight Against the Illicit Trafficking in Cultural Property. It is why we are so concerned about the contents of this memorandum, the one that Spinova found at the consulate, and which her killer presumably was after. You see, there is a far more sinister element to all of this.
He paused and looked meaningfully at them.
According to our sources, the items stolen, and in particular the gold figurine of the boy king, the figure of Tut codenamed Surfing the Panther in the memorandum, were transported to Libya shortly after the theft.
Madriani stopped writing when he heard about the gold statue and its codename.
They were placed in the care of an artisan, whose job it was to craft a number of identical replicas, Rashid said. The people at the Museum of Cairo would tell you that the damaged figurine was left behind by the looters. Of course, they had to say this. They even show pictures of it being restored. To say otherwise, given the political upheaval at the time, the change in government, well, heads would have rolled, quite literally, of those who are in charge of the museum. You see, the gold content of the figurine is minimal. It is its historical provenance that gives it vast monetary value. It is too recognizable to be sold to a legitimate museum, but private collectors would pay a fortune to obtain it for their own personal gratification. Because a buyer could not advertise its possession, the thieves would be free to make multiple copies and sell them to unwary but corrupt collectors at exorbitant prices, each one believing that they had the original item. Those buyers would never be able to disclose the fact that they paid tens of millions of dollars, perhaps more, for false replicas. They would be defrauded without recourse.
Makes good sense, Madriani said.
But here is the important part. It is the reason U.S. intelligence got involved in the first place. They uncovered the identity of one of the potential buyers who was bargaining for the original figurine. He was willing to pay a huge sum to acquire it.
Who is that? Said Alex.
According to our information, the former supreme leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, Rashid said. The reason for the memorandum, and again, we have not seen the document, but we have sources who tell us that Kim and the mastermind behind the theft had, as you say, struck a deal and agreed upon sum for delivery of the figurine. The price, if our information is correct, was $500 million U.S.
Madriani whistled as he looked up.
We're in the wrong business. Still, that's a considerable inducement for murder. Kill Spinova to keep her from taking her story and the CIA memo to the media.
Precisely, said Rashid.
How do you know all of this?
Madriani needed evidence.
It is my job, said Rashid.
Perhaps you can obtain a copy of the memorandum, the CIA memo from the State Department? Said Alex.
Rashid shook his head. They will not share information with us, not on this. I suspect it is because of the national security implications surrounding the North Korean involvement. We are aware that the United States is engaged in highly sensitive negotiations with Kim's son and successor, Kim Jong-un, Baby Kim, over nuclear weapons in North Korea. They are not going to jeopardize those negotiations over something like this. Madriani looked up from his notes. This was dynamite that could turn the tide in his defense of Mustafa. The problem was there was no way to ignite it. He needed proof, solid evidence. Otherwise, there was no way the trial judge would allow him to even mention it in front of the jury. Nine:30 Monday morning, and the intercom buzzed on Alex Cooper's desk. The office outside her door at 1 Hogan Place in Manhattan, the headquarters for the New York District Attorney's Office, hummed with activity. The voice on the intercom was Cooper's secretary.
Call for you on line one. I'm Mr. Rashid from UNESCO. Do you want me to take a message? Tell him you're busy?
No, I'll talk. Alex picked up the phone. Hello? Miss Cooper, I hope I did not catch you at a bad time. Mr. Rashid, I have a meeting in 20 minutes, but I can spare a moment.
I was wondering if you could tell me whether Mr. Madriani is still in town?
No, he left yesterday morning. Why do you ask?
Because I called his office in San Diego. They said he was out of the area, unavailable for several days, that he could not be reached. I didn't want to leave a message. What I have to tell him is highly confidential.
He was supposed to give his opening statement today.
That's what I was afraid of. Is there any way you can reach him?
I don't know. Is it urgent?
If he wants to save his client, it is vital.
What is it? Alex Cooper already knew more than she should have. It took Alex almost 2 hours to track Madriani down through his office in Coronado and from there to his cell phone in L.A. where she left a message. Just after 3 East Coast time, noon in L.A., he called her back during a break in the trial.
I hope it's important, said Madriani.
Pressed for time, are you?
Just a couple of sharks from the DA's office working their way up my leg from the ankle to the knee. Nothing to worry about.
Rashid has been trying to get a hold of you since yesterday, said Alex. He says the DA's office is about to lower the boom on your client.
I thought they already had, said Paul.
A witness by the name of Terry Mirza. Do you know the name? Asked Alex.
I do, said Paul. But how does Rashid know?
Be quiet and listen. You don't have much time. Rashid claims this guy Mirza saw your man dump Spinova's body in an alley in West L.A. the night of the murder. Mirza's name was on the state's witness list, but the information had not been released to the press or made public. Even Paul did not yet know the precise details of Mirza's testimony, only that he was a percipient witness to the body dump, only sketchy notes from police reports that the cops had left intentionally vague. They had closeted Mirza away since before the trial to keep him out of the clutches of Paul's investigators. Not that Mirza would have talked to any of them.
Why are you telling me this, Alex?
Because I trust you. I trust your reputation. And there are 2 ways to go at this. I happen to believe that a DA's job is to do justice.
What 2 ways do you have in mind?
Like I said, the DA out there is a good friend of mine. I'll call him. Maybe he'll listen to me. Take a hard look at what we give him about Cairo. Let him know he may be sitting on exculpatory evidence.
I hope your second idea makes more sense. He's been stonewalling me on this.
Look, Paul, I can't go rogue here, much as I might like to. But one of my best friends just left the office, Jenny Corcoran. She's waiting for a background check for an appointment she just got at Justice in D.C. She's a pit bull in the courtroom. She might work with you on this.
And you're telling me I can
trust her? Completely. You have my word.
So what will you say to the DA?
Paul asked. According to Rashid, this guy Mirza is going to tell the jury that he saw your man pull a large plastic bundle from the back seat of his cab in an alley off Lancashire Boulevard the night Spinova was killed. Presumably, the reason there was no blood in the back seat of your man's cab is because she was killed somewhere else and dumped there.
That's their theory, said Paul. Let me get this straight. Mirza can positively identify Mustafa as the man driving the cab and dumping the body?
Rock solid, according to Rashid, said Alex.
You're sure? I need to know how confident he is, whether I can shake him on cross.
Mirza had ID'd Mustafa from a photo array.
Paul already knew that.
He was hoping beyond hope that he could get the witness to equivocate on the identification, just a slight crack in the wall. After all, presumably, he was a disinterested witness with no stake in the case. Was he absolutely, positively, 1,000% certain it was Mustafa that he saw? No one was ever 1,000% sure of anything.
It might have been him. I can't be entirely sure.
This was all Paul needed. Something he could play with and stretch like a rubber band in front of the jury on closing and hope that it snapped. According to Rashid, Mirza will positively identify your client at the scene, and he won't be burdened by any doubts. Paul's heart climbed into his throat.
Don't tell me that Mirza has photographs of the body being dumped. And how does Rashid know all of this?
No, there are no photos, said Alex. Rashid says Mirza will be lying through his teeth.
What?
Listen carefully. Do you have a notepad? Here are the details on what Rashid told me. We're both going to have to move quickly.
The criminal courts building on Temple Street in downtown Los Angeles had an ominous feel for Modriani ever since the start of the Mustafa case. Even the courtroom was foreboding. Department 123 on the 13th floor. Had Modriani been superstitious, the only thing worse might have been the number of the beast, 666.
Bad news, too, that the DA had been off-put by Alex Cooper's attempt to intervene in one of his biggest cases. But Alex had surprised Modriani by taking the week off from her own job and flying out to be at the trial, sitting discreetly in the rear of the courtroom, one spectator among many, after her friend Jenny Corcoran confirmed that her presence might help Modriani get at the truth. This morning, on direct examination, the testimony of Terry Mirza was presented to the jury as if it were written, produced, and directed for a Broadway production with an audience of 12. It came on smooth as silk as the 9 women and 3 men in the jury box took notes and listened intently. There was not the slightest equivocation as Mirza identified the defendant, Ibid Mustafa, as the man he saw in the alley that night, the one who dragged the plastic-shrouded and bloodied body of Carla Spinova from the back seat of his yellow cab. Mirza even identified the cab number as well as the license plate number of the vehicle. He had everything but the VIN number off the engine block. When asked if he was absolutely certain that it was Mustafa that he saw that night, he said he had no doubt whatsoever. He told the jury that he observed the defendant clearly from several different angles as Mustafa struggled under the bright lights of a street lamp to drag the body over to the edge of the alley against the side of a building, where he left her and drove off. The witness also testified that the defendant was wearing gloves. This would explain the lack of fingerprints on the plastic tarp used to wrap the body. When the prosecutor had hammered the last nail in Mustafa's coffin and turned the witness over to Paul, the jurors were looking at Modriani as if to say, "Try and get out of that one." Paul introduced himself to the witness.
"Mr. Mirza, let me ask you, what is your first name, your given name? It's not Terry, is it?"
"No, it's Tariq."
"What is the origin of the name? I mean, it's not English or Irish or German."
"Objection, Your Honor. What's the relevance?"
"I think the jury has a right to know a little bit about the witness and where he's from," said Paul.
"I'll allow it," said the judge.
"But keep it short, Mr. Modriani." "Mr. Mirza, where is your family from?"
"My parents were Bedouins, from the desert, originally Saudi Arabia."
"Do you have family in Saudi Arabia at the present time?"
"I have an uncle who lives there."
"Were you born here in this country?"
"No. I came here when I was 3 with my mother and father and 2 brothers."
"Do you have any other relatives living in the Middle East, say, outside of Saudi Arabia at the present time?"
"Objection as to relevance, Your Honor."
The prosecutor was on his feet once more.
"May we approach the bench?"
said Modriani. The judge waved them on. Off to the side, away from the witness, Paul told the judge that the questions were intended to lay a foundation for the issue of credibility,
which was always relevant. After all, it was the prosecution who put the witness on the stand.
I will give you a little latitude, Mr. Modriani, but let's try and tie it to something in the case.
The judge eased back in his chair. Paul picked up where he left off.
Yes, said Mirza. I have one brother and my grandparents who live in Shubra al-Kaima.
And where is that?
Said Paul.
It's a town just outside Cairo in Egypt.
So your family lives in the same country my client is from?
If you say so, said Mirza.
When is the last time you spoke to your family in Egypt?
Said Paul.
I don't know. I don't remember.
A month ago?
Longer.
2 months?
I don't know. As I said, I can't remember.
Mr. Mirza, isn't it a fact that the testimony you have offered before this jury here today is false? Is it not true that you never saw anything that night and that, in fact, the information you have testified to here today was provided to you by outside parties who have threatened your family in Egypt unless you testify in accordance with their instructions?
No, that's not true, said Mirza.
Isn't it a fact, Mr. Mirza, that you received a letter, typed correspondence, hand-delivered to your home, instructing you to incriminate my client, telling you what to say, giving you details including the defendant's taxi number, the license number of the vehicle, the location of the alley, and other specifics, like the time of your supposed observations, and telling you that unless you did as the letter instructed, your family members in Egypt would be killed? Is that not a fact?
No. I don't know what you're talking about.
The discomfort level of the witness was obvious. Modriani lifted a sheaf of papers from the table in front of him. Beneath the papers were several large glossy photographs, as well as photocopies of a letter and its envelope. Modriani handed one set to the bailiff who delivered it to the judge, and another to the prosecutor.
May I approach the witness, Your Honor?
The judge nodded as he read from his copy of the letter.
Mr. Mirza, this is not the original, but a copy of the letter in question. The original has already been examined by a laboratory employed by the defense. It was turned over to the police for their examination less than an hour ago. I should tell you that our experts have already identified your fingerprints on the original letter and its envelope. You should be advised that perjury is a serious crime. I remind you that you are under oath.
Mirza looked at the document.
Your Honor, we've never seen this before.
The prosecutor was on his feet, waving his copy of the letter at the judge.
Neither had I, Your Honor, until late yesterday morning, said
Modriani.
When, subject to a subpoena, the letter was found in a safe deposit box belonging to Mr. Mirza at Fontana Bank in the city. It was tucked inside a large manila envelope containing some insurance documents.
I've never seen this before,
said Mirza, his hands shaking.
We would ask for a continuance, said the prosecutor.
Modriani ignored him.
Then perhaps you can explain to the jury and the judge how it came to find its way into your safe deposit box with your fingerprints on it?
The witness will answer the question.
One thing judges don't like is perjury. Mirza looked up at the judge, then toward the prosecutor, and finally at Modriani. A bewildered expression spread across his face.
I don't know. I really don't know.
6 days later, after the police crime lab verified Mirza's fingerprints on the letter and its envelope, both sides made their closing arguments to the jury. In the courtroom, crowded to overflowing, Alex Cooper sat just beyond the railing behind Modriani at the counsel table. In closing, it took little more than an hour for Modriani to shred the state's case, given that the testimony and evidence of the prosecution's chief witness had turned to dust. Other than the bleak GPS data putting Mustafa's taxi in the vicinity of the body dump, Mirza's testimony was the only real evidence tying him to the crime. Worse, it now appeared as if there was an active conspiracy afoot to frame Mustafa. Paul explained to the jury that while he could not defend Mirza's conduct on the stand, he understood the unwillingness on the part of the witness to own up to his perjury. After all, his family was in jeopardy, and he had reason to be afraid for them. Mirza, to the last breath, denied ever having seen the letter in question. He claimed that, to his knowledge, no one had ever threatened his family, and no one had told him what to say on the stand. He was adamant. No doubt the DA's office would take him to its own version of the woodshed for a thrashing on the issue of perjury if the jury failed to believe him. Still, there was no way to explain the fingerprints and the letter in the safe deposit box, all belonging to Mirza. After retiring to the jury room for deliberations, it seemed that the headiest item on the jury's agenda was the election of a foreman. Before the noon break, they were back with a verdict.
On the count of violation of Penal Code Section 187, first-degree murder, we, the jury, find the defendant, Ibid Mustafa, not guilty.
There was a veritable uproar in the courtroom as Mustafa was discharged by the judge. Modriani made plans to meet with him the following Monday at his office in San Diego. Mustafa left to get his personal belongings that had been taken from him the night of his arrest. Paul, Alex, and Jenny Corcoran retreated through the phalanx of reporters to a restaurant for lunch and a glass of wine. It was Friday afternoon. Alex had to fly back to New York, but Jenny was able to stay on. She made plans to get together with Paul and his girlfriend, Jocelyn Cole, as well as his law partner, Harry Hines, in San Diego for a quick visit. After lunch, some local sightseeing, and a heavy dinner, the lawyers parted as Paul dropped Alex at the airport. She was still conflicted, she told him, about how it felt to hear that Mustafa was acquitted when her first assumptions about his guilt in this heinous crime were so strong. Paul headed back to his own room. He would spend one more night in the City of Angels before collecting his luggage, picking Jenny up the following morning, and heading south to San Diego and home. As for Jenny, she was exhausted. As soon as she got to her room and showered, her head hit the pillow and she tried to sleep. But still, the subconscious was at work. Something troubled her. It was the testimony of Terry Mirza. In the true-to-form trials of the real world, Perry Mason endings, with witnesses crumbling on the stand and admitting their guilt, do not occur, except in one narrow band of cases. People who commit perjury and who are confronted on the stand with irrefutable evidence of their lies often do recant their testimony, particularly when admonished by counsel and the judge in stern language that perjury is a serious crime for which they could pay a stiff penalty, including time behind bars if convicted. Mirza had been told this several times, and still he stuck to his testimony. He insisted that he had never seen the letter threatening his family or directing him how to testify. The letter had still another quality to it, like a rabbit pulled from a hat. Samir Rashid somehow had acquired information about Mirza and his family in Egypt. According to Rashid, they were under a severe threat of death from the people who had raided the Cairo Museum and stolen the golden figurine, Surfing the Panther. These people had already killed Carla Spinova to get their hands on the memorandum left behind in the charred U.S. consulate building in Benghazi, the memo that identified the mastermind behind the museum theft, as well as the deal for the sale to the North Korean dictator. Rashid's same sources had told him about the letter delivered to Mirza and the threat to his family. The Cairo thieves were desperate to convict Mustafa for Spinova's murder, to make her death appear to be a brutal sexual assault, staged to seem so, because it would put an end to the controversy and leave them free to do their deals with their stolen booty. Case solved. Story over. It all made sense. Sort of. Slowly, her subconscious released her, and Jenny drifted off to sleep. She couldn't tell how long the slumber lasted, minutes or hours, disoriented as she was in the dark room. But she was awakened with a start by the noise next to her head. She opened her eyes in the dark, little blinking lights in unfamiliar places, and the sound of the electronic ringtone blaring next to the bed. She grabbed for the receiver and found it on the second stab.
Hello?
Hello, Jenny. Paul Modriani here. I'm sorry to wake you.
What is it?
She looked at the clock on the nightstand. It was 4:30 in the morning.
We need to talk. The police called me 10 minutes ago. Ibid Mustafa is dead.
What?
He was killed by a hit-and-run driver at an intersection in West Los Angeles 2 hours ago. The police found my business card with the hotel phone number in Mustafa's pocket. They said he was drunk, stumbled into the street, and got nailed. According to witnesses, the driver sped off.
Jenny's mind, still half asleep, raced, trying to absorb it all.
Corcoran, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Mustafa was Islamic, devout. He prayed 5 times a day. More to the point, he didn't drink.
An hour later, the two lawyers sat bleary-eyed, hunched over the table in Paul's hotel room, gulping coffee from styrofoam cups, something from an all-night cafe on the corner.
I don't believe in coincidence, said Jenny. You want to know what I think?
What?
Said Paul.
I think Mirza was telling the truth. I don't think he'd ever seen that letter before. I mean, you had him in a vice right there on the stand, squeezing him with hard evidence. Why not own up? After all, if your family is in jeopardy, it's no longer a secret.
Then how did his prints get on the letter in the envelope?
Blank paper, said Jenny. Maybe somebody got into his house. We all stack paper in our printers. Somebody could have taken the bottom page from the feeder. Or better, somebody hands Mirza a blank piece of paper in an envelope. He opens it, looks at it. Whoever gives it to him says, oops, wrong envelope, takes it back and gives him something else. Mirza never thinks twice about it. The contents of the letter are then typed or printed on the blank page, and suddenly the witness is confronted with it in court.
You're forgetting something. How did the letter get into Mirza's safe deposit box?
Said Madriani.
Where there's a will, there's a way. You said it was found inside an envelope with some insurance documents.
Right.
Where did the insurance papers come from?
I don't know. I assume an insurance agency.
Yes, and we, as well as the court, all assumed that Mirza either hid the letter or misfiled it with his insurance papers. Now let me ask you, who reads insurance documents? Said Jenny.
Paul looked at her.
Nobody.
Exactly. You receive them and you file them away somewhere safe. Anybody could have gotten to that manila envelope with the insurance documents and slipped whatever they wanted in it before it was delivered to Mirza. Look again, and you might find pictures of Mirza shooting from the grassy knoll in Dealey Plaza.
Paul thought for a moment.
And who knew exactly where to look for the letter?
Rashid, said Jenny.
She looked at her watch, picked up the receiver on the nightstand, and started dialing, first an outside line.
Who are you calling?
Alex. I need to pick her brain, but it's going right to voicemail.
She may still be airborne.
Paul said. Jenny tried again and asked for information this time.
I would like the phone number for New York, the United Nations, UNESCO, if there is a separate listing.
What about his business card?
Said Paul.
Jenny shook her head. If I'm right, that's probably an answering service. They'll answer with any name a client gives them.
10 minutes later, they had the news. The good part was that UNESCO had its own main number. The bad news was that no one by the name of Samir Rashid worked there. There was no listing under that name for any employee. Jenny slammed the receiver into the cradle.
He played you and Alex like a piano. How the hell did he get into the building? His office?
After hours on a Saturday night,
said Paul,
and the janitor who just happened to be going in through the side door. The man is just full of coincidences. He used the service elevator instead of the bank of elevators near the main entrance. I should have known it was way too smooth.
No going through security, said Jenny.
Exactly. He probably paid the janitor at the door to let Alex and me in. You hang a few pictures and certificates on the wall, put a holder with business cards on the desk, slip a plastic plaque with your name on the office door, and you're in business. What we saw is what he wanted us to see. It's all about confidence, said Paul. Put yourself in the right setting, surround yourself with a cloak of authority, and you can peddle anything.
To two gullible lawyers searching for the truth, said Jenny, and all you got was smoke and mirrors. Alex will go ballistic.
Don't be so hard on us. We were the perfect marks. I've got a loser of a case. He's got the answer, the solution to all my problems. He plays on the interests of justice. We both wanted the fair result, especially when we figured out that Mustafa was being set up.
Why does he want to get Mustafa off? Said Jenny.
Mustafa killed Spinova, said Paul. He had something Rashid wanted, and he was holding it over Rashid's head unless Rashid helped him beat the charges.
What?
The CIA memorandum, said Paul.
What? You think that was real? Said Jenny.
The best con is one that includes a kernel of truth. Mustafa killed Spinova to get the memo, and he got it. But in the process, he got nailed. Mirza saw him dump the body. Cops caught up with him, and Mustafa used the memo, which, unless I'm wrong, identifies Rashid as the mastermind behind the Cairo Museum theft. Mustafa used the memo to extort Rashid. Help me or else. If Mustafa goes down for the count, he uses the memo and the evidence in it to cut a deal for himself come sentencing.
Enter two overanxious lawyers, said Jenny, and Alex trying to do the right thing by the dead woman. Make sure the wrong guy isn't convicted unfairly. Those autopsy pictures haunted her.
Now Mustafa's dead. The memo's gone, said Paul. And God knows where Rashid is, assuming that's even his name, which you and I both know it is not. He may be a lot of things, but stupid is not one of them.
I hate being used like this, said Jenny.
You think I like it? I had an obligation to defend Mustafa to the best of my ability. But suborning perjury was not included among my services.
So what do we do? Said Jenny.
You got me, said Paul. We could go to the trial judge and the DA and explain what happened. Of course, what good is that? Even if Mustafa were alive, he would be beyond the reach of the court, double jeopardy being what it is, which is redundant in this case since he's dead.
Rashid is a co-conspirator, said Jenny. He's still liable.
Try and find him, said Paul. He's busy peddling his wares, little golden statues, remember?
Yes, I heard about them, said Jenny. She thought for a moment. There was a twinkle in her eye. That's it.
What?
The answer.
The answer to what? Said Paul.
A woman scorned. Alex will want a hand in this. Maybe the DA will listen to her now.
Eight days later, a sleek Gulfstream G650 touched down on the runway at the heavily guarded airport just outside Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. It taxied to a stop in front of a large hangar as the stairway was wheeled up next to the door. It swung open, and a man stepped out onto the platform. He was carrying a small wooden box under one arm. The man who called himself Samir Rashid looked down at the official entourage waiting for him at the foot of the steps. Behind them, the line of shiny black limousines and security cars waiting to escort him to the government house, what is called the Grand People's Study House. Rashid walked briskly down the steps until he reached the tarmac, where he extended his right hand in greeting toward the general who was first in line. Before the officer could take it, a guard stepped around him and quickly slapped the cold, hard metal of handcuffs around Rashid's right wrist. Another guard took possession of the wooden box while they manacled Rashid's other hand.
What is this? What are you doing?
Silence, said the general. You will come with me. Is this the statue?
He gestured toward the box.
It is, and your leader will be very angry with you for the manner in which I am being treated. There is no excuse for this. I had an arrangement with his father and have an understanding with your dear leader. I assure you he will be very upset when I speak to him about this. Yes, said the general. Perhaps you can explain the meaning of this to him.
The officer reached for something handed to him by one of his subordinates standing next to him. It was a newspaper, two of them actually. Copies of the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Each of them one day old. Blaring headlines just below the fold from New York. Audacious theft from Cairo Museum. Attempt to sell bogus Tut statues. From Los Angeles, the revelation. prosecutor unveils elaborate fraud in Spinova murder trial. Co-conspirator on the lam. Rashid's eyes raced over the newsprint, trying to absorb the full impact of the words. Adrenaline flooded his heart as glimpses of his fate revealed themselves here and there in the words on the page. Golden knockoffs. North Korean dictator. Unsuspecting buyers. Fraud. Murder. The last of which seemed to be the least of Rashid's worries. In that instant, the man who had called himself Samir Rashid knew that he would never leave North Korea alive. It is true, what they say. Justice is a funny thing. It comes in many different forms.
Jeffrey Deaver versus John Sanford. Combining Lincoln Rhyme and Lucas Davenport in a single adventure seemed an insurmountable problem. Rhyme, the hero of Jeffrey Deaver's series that began with The Bone Collector, 1997, is a quadriplegic and, of necessity, sticks close to home in New York City. Davenport, the star of John Sanford's Prey series, is an ace investigator living in Minnesota, working presently for that state's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. How could the two ever meet? Fortunately, Davenport's talents as a no-nonsense, take-no-prisoners cop have transported him to the Big Apple before. In Silent Prey, 1992, NYPD Detective Lily Rothenberg enlisted Davenport's aid in nailing the psychotic killer, Dr. Michael Becker, who was prowling the streets of Manhattan. Rhyme, too, has a partner, Detective Amelia Sachs. So Jeff and John decided it was a natural fit for this foursome to join forces to tackle the case of a murderous sculptor for whom art and death are inextricably and gruesomely intertwined. The combination of these four was particularly harmonious since Lucas Davenport and Lily Rothenberg are known for their streetwise policing and skill at psychological profiling, while Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia Sachs ply the complementary skill of forensic science. Together, they take on the task of figuring out who's doing what and why to victims in Lower Manhattan's chic art scene. The process of writing this story was seamless. Both John and Jeff are experienced at this sort of thing. Together, they developed an outline, comprising about 8 scenes, then divided up the task of writing each one. Jeff handled the crime scene and forensics-oriented portions, John the undercover and street investigations. Rather than writing serially, one section after the other, sending the finished portions to each other, amazingly they worked simultaneously. When the rough story was finished, they each polished the completed manuscript, combined edits, and voila, they had a story. It's a chilling tale, one filled with each author's trademark reversals and twists. You'll think twice about ever walking into an art gallery again. And heaven help you if you ever strike up a conversation with a stranger in a bar.
Rhymes with Prey. The night was hot and close, and the midsummer perfume of Central Park West, the odor of melted bubblegum mixed with discarded cheese pretzels and rotten bananas or something just like that, seeped into the back seat of the taxi as it cleared 57th Street and headed north. The taxi driver was Pakistani from Karachi, he said, a slender, mild-mannered man who smelled lightly of cumin with an overlay of Drakkar Noir cologne. He listened to what might have been Pakistani jazz or Afghani rap or something even more exotic. The couple in the back seat wouldn't have known the difference, if there was any difference. When the male passenger asked how big Karachi was, the driver said, "More big than New York City, but more small than New York City if includes the sub-burgers." The woman said, "Really?" with an edge of skepticism. The Pakistani picked up the skepticism and said, "I look in Wiki, and this is what Wiki say." The male passenger was from Minnesota, and not knowing any better, or because he was rich and didn't care, overtipped the driver as he and the woman got out of the cab. As it moved away, he said to her, "I could use a sub-burger right now with ketchup and fries." "You just don't want to deal with Rhyme," she said. "He makes you nervous." Lucas Davenport looked up at Lincoln Rhyme's townhouse, a Victorian pile facing the park, with a weak, old-fashioned light over the doorway. I'm getting over it. When I first went in there, I had a hard time looking at him. That pissed him off. I could feel it, and I feel kind of bad about it. Didn't have any trouble looking at Amelia, said Lily Rothenberg. Be nice, Lucas said, as they walked toward the front steps. I'm happily married. Doesn't keep you from checking out the market, Lily said. I don't think she's on the market, Lucas said. He made a circling motion with an index finger. I mean, can they? I don't know, Lily said. Why did you ask? Just wait until I'm out of there. Maybe not, Lucas said. I'm getting over it, but I'm not that far over it, and he's not exactly Mr. Warmth. Somebody might say that about you, too, Lily observed. Hey, nobody said that to me while getting busy in my Porsche. Lily laughed and turned a little pink. Way back before their respective marriages, they dallied. In fact, Lucas had dallied her brains loose in a Porsche 911, a feat that not everyone thought possible, especially for people their size. A long time ago, when we were young, she said as they climbed the steps to Lincoln's front door. I was slender as a fairy then. Lucas was a tall man, heavy in the shoulders, with a hawk nose and blue eyes. His black hair was touched with a bit of silver at the temples, and a long, thin scar ran from his forehead across his brow ridge and down onto his cheek, the product of a fishing accident. Another scar on his throat was not quite as outdoorsy, though it happened outdoors, when a young girl shot him with a piece of crap 22 and he almost died. Lily was dark-haired and full-figured, constantly dieting and constantly finding more interesting things to eat. She never gained enough to be fat, couldn't lose enough to be thin. She'd never been a fairy. She was paid as a captain in the NYPD, but she was more than that, one of the plain-clothes influentials who floated around the top of the department, doing things meant to be invisible to the media. As someone said of her, she was the nut cutter they called when nuts seriously needed to be cut. Like now. She'd brought Lucas in as a consultant from the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension because she didn't know who she could trust in her own department. They might have a serial killer cop on the loose, or even worse, a bunch of cops. And if that was right, the cops wouldn't be out of control dumbass flatfoots, but serious guys, narcotic detectives, who'd become fed up with the pointlessness and ineffectiveness of the war on drugs. The four dead were all female, all illegal Mexicans. All had been tortured, and all had some connection to drug sales, although with two of them, Lucas thought, the connection was fairly thin. Still, if they were dealing with the cartels, and if there was a turf war going on, they could have been killed simply as warnings. And torture was something the cartels did as other people might play cards. On the other hand, the women may have been tortured not as punishment or to make a point, but for information. Somebody, the commissioner feared, had decided to take direct action to eliminate the drug problem, with the emphasis on eliminate. The bodies were piling up, so he called his nut cutter, and the nut cutter called Lucas. The duo had just been downtown checking out and talking with the honchos that made up the department's famous Narcotics Unit 4, or infamous, some said. The trio of shields, two men and a woman, had earned the highest drug conviction rate in the city with, the rumors went, less than kosher tactics. Lately, they'd been running ops in the area where the women had been killed. Lily pushed the doorbell. Amelia Sachs came to the door, chewing on a celery stalk, and let them in. She was a tall woman, slender and redheaded, a former model which pushed several of Lucas's buttons. Given all of that, their relationship had been testy, maybe because of Lucas's initial attitude toward Lincoln and his disability. Lincoln was in his Storm Arrow wheelchair, peering at a high-def video screen. Without looking at them, he said, "You got nothing." "Not entirely true," Lucas said. "All three of them were dressed carelessly." Lincoln turned his head and squinted at him. "Why is that important?" Lucas shrugged. Anyone who dresses carelessly bears watching, in my estimation, he said. He was wearing a Ralph Lauren purple label summer weight wool suit in medium blue, a white dress shirt with one of the more muted Hermes ties, and bespoke shoes from a London shoemaker. Amelia made a rude noise, and Lucas grinned at her, or at least showed his teeth. Easy, Lily said. To Lincoln, you're basically right. We got nothing. We weren't exactly stonewalled, we were know-nothinged. Like it was all a big puzzle, and why were we there? Were they acting? Lincoln asked. Hard to tell, Lucas said. Most detectives are good liars. But if somebody put a gun to my head, I'd say no, they weren't acting. They didn't know what we were talking about.
I like that concept, Amelia said.
What? Lucas asked. Lying?
No, putting a gun to your head.
Lily rolled her eyes.
Amelia. Just having fun, Lily, Amelia said. You know I love Lucas like a brother.
And I hope it stays that way, Lincoln grumped. Anyway, while you were out touring the city, we've made some significant progress here. There were some anomalies in the autopsy photos that I thought worth revisiting. The bodies were found nude, of course, and so dirt and sand had been comprehensively impressed in the victim's skins, along with grains of concrete. However, in examining the photos, I noticed that in several of these flecks we were getting more light return than you might expect from grains of sand or soil or concrete. The photos were taken with flash, of course, a very intense light. The enhanced light return would not have been especially noticeable under the lights of an autopsy table. I sent Amelia to investigate. I found that all four victims had tiny bits of metal ingrained in their skin. The cut surfaces were shiny, which is why Lincoln was able to see them in the high-res photos, Amelia said. There weren't many of them, but some in each. I recovered them.
And brought them here, Lincoln said.
They were uniform in size and smaller than the average brown sugar ant. We ran them through the GDS-400A glow discharge spectrometer, a Hewlett-Packard gas chromatograph, and a Geol SEM-scanning electron microscope. Those are instruments for determining the composition of a liquid, gas, or solid. I know what they are. I'm a cop, not a fucking moron, Lucas said. Lincoln continued without acknowledging the interruption, and found that they were flecks of bronze.
Lily said, bronze? That's good, right? We need a bronze working shop.
Amelia said, it's good in a way. The fact is, bronze has become pretty much a specialty metal. It's used to make bells, cymbals, some ship propellers, Olympic medals, and bronze wool replaces steel wool for some woodworking applications. It's used in high-end weather stripping for doors.
Lincoln, impatient, said, yes, yes, yes. But the flecks are not bronze wool, and they are rounded, with no flat sides, as you would get from weather stripping and so on.
Nor do they appear to be millings, which you would get with propellers and cymbals and such, because the grain size is too consistent.
How about sculpture? Lucas asked.
Lincoln was momentarily disconcerted, then said, I concluded that since the grains were so uniformly sized and so sharply cut, they most likely came from a hand-filing process. The most common hand-filing process used with bronze involves sculpture casting. Lucas said to Lily, that was apparent to me as soon as they mentioned bronze.
Quite, Lincoln said.
Lily,
so we're looking for a foundry?
Perhaps not, Lincoln said. There is another aspect worth mentioning. There weren't many of these bronze filings. I surmise that the murders may have taken place not in the foundry area, where you would expect a variety of returns from the casting process, and we have no bronze-related returns other than these flecks, and probably not even in the filing or grinding area. It appears to me that the grains were tracked into the area where the murders took place. Still, the kill site was near the filing area, or there would have been even fewer grains.
Lucas said, so what, we're looking for a room off a studio? Maybe even living quarters?
Not living quarters. I think we're looking for a loft of some kind, a loft with a concrete floor. All four victims had flecks of concrete buried in their skin, but two of them were found lying on blacktop, not concrete. And it's an empty building, probably an abandoned warehouse.
Where do you get that? Lucas asked. Lincoln twitched his shoulders, which Lucas had learned was a shrug. The women weren't gagged. Whoever killed them let them scream, either because it didn't bother them or because they enjoyed it, and they felt safe in letting them scream. Lucas nodded at him. Interesting, he said. Lily ticked it off on her fingers. We're looking for a male, probably, because they're the ones who do this kind of thing. Either a sculptor or somebody who works with a sculptor, who has a studio or a workshop in an empty warehouse. Either that or somebody picked the building without knowing about the bronze filings, Amelia said. They have nothing to do with bronze except that they happened to pick a place with bronze filings on the floor. Could have been there forever. I doubt that, Lincoln said. It's a logical possibility, though, Lily said. Lucas, I'm with Lincoln on this. Lily asked, why? Lincoln looked at Lucas and said, you tell them. Because the particles are still shiny enough that Lincoln picked them up on the bodies. They're new. Lily nodded, and Amelia said, okay. And he's a freak. He's a sadomasochist who knows what he's doing. He's got a record, Lucas said. He turned to Lily. Time to fire up the computers. And the computers were fired up, not by Lucas, Lily, Amelia, or Lincoln, but by a clerk in the basement of the FBI building in Washington. Lily spoke quietly into the shell-like ear of the chief of detectives, Stan Markowitz, who spoke to a pal in the upper strata of the FBI, who wrote a memo that drifted down through several layers of the bureaucracy and wound up on the desk of an inveterate war game player named Barry. Barry read the note and punched in a bunch of keywords and found, oddly enough, that there were four bronze sculptors in the United States who had been arrested for sex crimes involving some level of violence, and two of them had had studios in New York. One of them was dead, but James Robert Verlaine wasn't. James Robert Verlaine, Lily read the next morning. They were in Lincoln's crime lab, once a parlor. Or as we know him, Jim Bob, Lucas said. Has a fondness for cocaine, has been arrested twice for possession of small amounts, did no time. Also arrested years ago for possession of LSD, did 2 months. 4 years ago, he was charged with possession of 30 hits of ecstasy, but he'd wiped the Ziploc bag they were in and he'd thrown it into the next toilet stall, where it landed in the toilet and wasn't fished out for a while. Quite a while, somebody hadn't flushed. The prosecutor dumped it for faulty chain of evidence. Last year he was arrested in an apartment over on Skid Row in a raid on a meth cooker, but he was released when it turned out the actual cooker was the woman who was renting the apartment. Verlaine said he was just an innocent visitor. The prosecutor dumped it again, insufficient evidence. Get to the sex, Lucas said. He's never been arrested for a sex crime, but he's been investigated, Lily said, reading from the FBI report. He's known for sculptures with slave themes involving bondage, whipping, various kinds of subjugation of women. A woman named Tina Martinez, note the last names here, complained to police that he'd injured a friend of hers named Maria Corso, who was supposedly modeling for one of these bondage sculptures. Corso refused to prosecute, said there'd been a misunderstanding with her friend. The investigators say they believe she was paid off. He's a bad man, Amelia said. Bad, Lincoln agreed, with a substantial interest in drugs. And probably with the kind of